Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. My name is Justin Landon, and I am the host of this show. I don't have necessarily a huge topic this week. I just have a really awesome guest. Her name is Myrrh. Myrrh Lafferty is the author of 5 novels, including The Shambling Guide to New York City and The Ghost Train to New Orleans. She's written a host of novellas in her Afterlife series, the most recent of which is titled Stones, and was just recently finished. She's the host of the award-winning podcast I Should Be Writing, and the former host of Pseudopod and Escape Pod, and she won the 2013 John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer. Welcome, Myrrh.
Thanks for having me. Rocket Talk. Exciting.
I know. It's a very, like, dynamic name, isn't it?
It is. It is. Good use of consonants.
Yeah, it was not my idea. I suggested the very terrible, so Stubby is the mascot of Tor.com.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suggested the Stubby's Soapbox is the title of the podcast, which thankfully the editorial team at Tor.com shot down immediately and humbly suggested Rocket Talk, which I was more than happy to embrace. So speaking of podcasting, you have been podcasting since like the dawn of the podcast, right?
Almost, yeah.
It's been 9 years?
About 10 minutes after the dawn, yeah. I mean, almost 10.
Wow.
It'll be 10 years next month.
I mean, you're so into podcasting, your agent even has a podcast.
I think she had that before I signed with her, actually. I was so proud.
Yeah. Okay, so you didn't make her start it. All right, well, that's...
No.
So you started recording I Should Be Writing back in 2004, right?
Actually, I started another podcast in 2004. I Should Be Writing started August 2005.
Okay. What made you decide way back in the yesteryears of the early aughts that you should start a podcast going into the interwebs? Because like I thought this was a good idea like last year, and you were clearly way ahead of me.
It just seemed like a fun idea. I'd started writing various geeky nonfiction essays. And strangely enough, NPR was not buying at that time geeky nonfiction essays. I think they still aren't, but they would be more open to it now. But at the time, no one was interested. And so I thought when I started hearing about podcasting, I was trying to think of, well, that sounds like fun. What can I do? And I thought I could just start podcasting my essays. And it kind of turned into a little audio blog in addition to the essays. And then... And a couple of months later, because I was already addicted heavily, Mike Stackpole was doing his writing podcast, The Secrets. And I was at a point in my career where I was not selling yet, but I understood how the business worked and knew that a lot of the myths that a lot of new writers I know still believe were untrue. And so I thought I would do a podcast about the writing business from the new writer's point of view. And so that's where I Should Be Writing came from.
And that's been going on for so long. And I've listened to it off and on over the years, not being much of a writer myself. I often listen to it and I'm like, wow, that sounds like not so much fun. being a writer.
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of people say what they like about my show is that I'm completely honest. I'm honest about my successes, my failures, dealing with depression. I'm honest about all that because I want people to know that if they have a bad day or they have a stumble, then they're not alone. It happens to all of us. There are some things, of course, I can't talk about because it's bad business to do so, but I try to be as transparent as possible.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, you've done something on that show. You're not by yourself all the time. I mean, you have guests time to time as well, but like you record whole shows by yourself, which as a fellow podcaster, I find incredibly amazing because I can't talk to myself. But
really? Oh, gosh. I don't know. Dealing with somebody else requires me to actually work on a schedule, and I'm very bad at that. I'm usually like, oh, I have a free hour. I think I'll record. And no one else is at my house to respond to that and help me record. So I just kind of talk into the mic. The weird thing is that I find blogging very difficult because once I sit down to write my thoughts, like I get them down on the paper and I'm like, oh, wow, that looks completely pointless and inconsequential. And no one's going to give a crap about that. But I can talk into a mic for an hour. I don't know where that comes from or what that says about me, but that's why I don't blog as much, because I'd much rather just talk into a mic and get it out there.
Yeah, that's awesome. I keep thinking about, like, man, I'm, you know what, this week I couldn't book a guest. I'm just totally going to wing it and just go on there and talk about stuff I care about. And then I'm like, number one, it would be terrible. And number two, the things that would come out of my mouth would get Tor.com to immediately fire me. So it's good that I have this, the guest to keep me honest.
So, you know, I don't believe the first one, but I could maybe believe the second part.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's probably a problem. So in addition to I Should Be Writing, I mean, you've also done some other podcasts. You did Pseudopod and Escape Pod, and those are audio fiction on podcasts. And it feels like to me, I mean, we're in the middle of like what I would call kind of an audio fiction revolution, it seems like. I mean, people are really into audiobooks now. I mean, we're seeing things like Patrick Rothfuss's new book, The Slow Regard of Silent Things. I mean, he's like recording his own audiobook, and it's like this huge deal. But
is it?
Everybody's kind of talking about it.
Why is it a huge deal?
Well, people are talking about it, right? Because it's Pat Rothfuss, and he's recording his own book, and they did a lot of press releases about it. It seemed like a big deal, although people have been doing this for a while, right?
I recorded my own book.
Yes, you did. You did your own. Mary Robinette Kowal does her own. But people are consuming audio fiction more than they used to, it seems like to me.
I mean, yes.
Because I'm consuming it now, and I never used to. And it seems like the podcasts, the audio fiction podcasts like Pseudopod and Escape Pod, like got on this back in the mid-2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems like audio fiction has kind of exploded in the last couple of years. Like, is that accurate?
I think so. It's been a way for some of us, you know, built our careers on putting out fiction for free via podcasts. This was before Audible embraced self-publishing. And, you know, Escape Pod and Pseudopod have been in the black since the beginning. You know, we've never been in the red. We've never dipped into our founders' pockets. And that's completely donation-based. So people are interested in this kind of thing and willing to support it, which is fantastic. You know, people support my stuff on occasion, which just still astonishes me because, you know, they can get most of it for free, but, you know, they will pay for just to support or for premium content if I can actually get off my butt and get it out.
Yeah, dude, your Patreon is kind of kicking ass.
Yes, yes. Promising a daily podcast for all of November did that.
Wow. That's more than I would ever commit to, so I salute you.
Yeah, I did 6 episodes yesterday because I can't podcast on the road, and that was a little bit of a burnout right there.
Yeah.
And it was great because I kept saying, I have no idea where I am on this day of NaNoWriMo because it's still day 3 for me.
That is kind of in the spirit of NaNoWriMo, right? Just bank it when you can.
Yes, exactly.
The interesting thing about the audio fiction thing is I wonder how much of that was driven sort of by, I remember as a kid, you know, my mom had a long commute and she used to get audiobooks and she'd get them from the library and like it was a big production, right? And I remember going to the store to like buy audiobooks and they were so expensive.
I know.
And so this audio fiction on podcast was sort of like creating, there's obviously a need for it, but it was so expensive that these audio podcasts made it more accessible and made people realize they wanted it more maybe.
That sounds quite logical to me. I mean, that's granted, it's really a lot of work. And I don't know if I would recommend someone build their career the way Scott Sigler did, the way I did, because there are a whole bunch more people doing it now, and it is so much work to do it right.
Well, and that's one of the interesting things I think you're probably kind of positioned to comment on, which is like the podcasting game has changed drastically in the last 9 years. I mean, I'm sure when you got started in 2004, 2005, the field was a lot different than it is today.
Oh, yeah.
I assume it's just the basic. There's a glut of stuff in, you know, the quote unquote marketplace. But have you seen any other major changes, major shifts?
It was a weird sort of, wait, they're taking over our clubhouse feeling when NPR and a lot of, say, pro comedians and stuff started getting into the game. And we used to be podcasters, and then suddenly we were indie podcasters because we weren't legit or something. I'm not really sure. But on the other hand, it gave us credibility. You know, back in 2005, no one knew what the word meant, and now NPR is talking about their podcasts all the time. I suppose as it gets bigger, we get more credentials and also get kind of put in the background. I don't know. I'm never good at looking at something from a very wide point of view. I think that's one of my great failings, actually. I turn out to be a little bit myopic sometimes. I don't follow as much podcast fiction as I used to, partly because I'm more of a Netflix-type binge watcher. I want to listen to as much of an audiobook as I can without worrying about waiting for the next episode. Although waiting for the next episode was one thing that get people interested and talking about you for months. They could either download your entire audiobook. One time I uploaded one of my novellas. I recorded it all at once. I uploaded it all at once. And I sat there the night that it went up, and I sat there feeling so pleased with myself and so tired. And it was about a two-hour-long novella, and 2 hours after I uploaded it, I started getting emails going, "Where's the next one?" And I'm like, "You didn't even give me a chance to catch my breath." So it's. I think it's just like the internet. It's an ever-changing landscape, and you have to ride with it or steadfastly stand against it and get drowned.
It does seem that there's a whole, and so obviously I come at this kind of from the science fiction and fantasy community perspective, and it seems like, based on my experience at Balticon a couple of times, which has a really aggressive podcasting kind of program to it, it seems like there's like a whole podcasting subculture out there, if you will. You know, people who listen to podcasts, who consume podcasts, who make podcasts. And it's sort of like a circle in some way, kind of in the same way there's a community around, I would say, the science fiction and fantasy fiction magazines, you know, where there's a lot of the readers are also the consumers are also the creators.
I know a lot of people who started out as fans who started doing their own shows. I mean, it's a lot of work, but the learning threshold is not as... It's pretty easy work once you learn how to do it. So it's the learning curve is not high. It's just a whole lot of work. But people discovered that, hey, this is something cool and I can do it. So a lot of people that I know I met through podcasting as fans have gone on to do their own shows. And that's one thing I love about the thing is that I know people who now have more listeners than I do. And they started because they heard I should be writing. I think the community is still there. I unfortunately missed Balticon this year, so I wasn't sure how strong the new media track was then. But people like Writing Excuses and Scott Sigler have whole events, whole weekend-long events or week-long events around their shows. So clearly they're getting some major fanatics willing to follow them places and spend lots of money. So the community is still pretty strong, I'd say.
Yeah, that's amazing. You are actually in Washington, D.C. right now, right?
Yes.
And you're there for, speaking of conventions, you're there for the World Fantasy Convention.
Yes.
I'm kind of upset with myself that I'm not there.
I'm kind of sad, too.
I know.
Why aren't you here?
I know. It's, family and
yeah.
You know, there's only so many.
Travel.
I've been asking everybody to commit to not having a good time without me.
I will do my best. I am in a con hotel. I'm in a hotel that's far from the con hotel, and it does not have a bar. So I fully expect to be sitting here most nights.
Whoa. What? No bar? That's a tragedy. I thought World Fantasy was all about the bar.
Oh, it is. I'm not in the con hotel.
Man. Well, when you are in the con hotel, please have a drink for me. And,
but you just said not to have fun. I'm confused.
I don't want you to... I don't want you to totally burn your trip out. I just want you to, like, okay, pretend not to have fun.
Okay. I will pretend not to have fun.
Maybe tweet about it at some point. Say, like, hashtag not having fun because Justin's not here. I mean, that would be great. You know, something like that.
We will make that hashtag trend.
All right, thank you. I appreciate that. You know, ironically, though, and this, I guess, kind of ironically, this is probably a misuse of the word ironic, but World Fantasy always manages to align with National Novel Writing Month.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise known as NaNoWriMo. So as all of these authors are gathering to waste 4 days of time drinking and talking shop and all of this, you know, half of them are in the middle of doing NaNoWriMo. And you are doing NaNoWriMo this year.
Yes, although I fail every year. I don't feel too bad about it because I know I can start and finish a book. But I've always wanted to actually do the 50,000 in 1 month, and I never have. But I'm hoping this year is the time. Of course, I'm behind already, but, you know.
It doesn't matter. You just need a 15,000-word day, and you're right back up. So you were talking a lot about Nano this year because you, as we talked mentioned earlier with your Patreon, you have offered to do these daily podcasts about Nano, right? I mean, as somebody who has successfully completed a novel several times over, and I'm sure you have more novels that you finished that have not seen the light of day, perhaps.
For the best.
For the best. Why do you think the Nano process is important?
I think it's extremely important for beginners because from my experience as a writer and knowing lots of writers at different stages of their career, the biggest problem all writers have is fear of, well, not fear of perfection, but demanding perfection. They can't write chapter two until chapter one is perfect. And if they're not a veteran of 20, 30 years of writing, I doubt they're ever going to write a perfect first chapter. And they have to move beyond that fear of writing bad prose. And, you know, we allow ourselves to be bad. You don't expect to go out and do a marathon if you decide to be a runner. You don't just open your door and run 26 miles, but people keep thinking, well, I'm going to be a writer. Now my novel is going to be perfect. I'm going to set out and do a novel and it's going to be perfect. And then they wonder why it's not. And they won't allow themselves to actually work up to it. And NaNoWriMo insists. Basically, if you sit there and think about what you're writing, you're going to fall behind and you're not going to hit your 50,000 words. So basically it says, look, you can start and finish a project. It doesn't have to be perfect. Just learn what it is to write every day. Some people kind of see it as a religious thing, as only something, you know, kind of like going to church only on Easter and Christmas. They do NaNoWriMo once a year, and that's the only time they write novels. But I know a lot of other people who try to see it as a jump start. You know, they get in the habit of writing every day. Maybe they don't continue to write 1,667 words a day, but maybe they keep writing every day and see that even if you don't do that many words, it does pile up and you can actually finish a project that seemed so huge to you 2 months ago. And it's also got the community aspect of allowing people to see a whole bunch of other people start a project at the exact same time as they do. And they can, you know, you've got that feeling of we're all in this together. One thing I discovered is if you're like me and I've been doing basically the minimum every day and feeling pretty good about myself, but then I look and I see a couple of my friends are binging. And while I've got, you know, 4,500 words, a friend of mine has 12,000. So then I start to feel bad about myself there. But then I remember if I'm just at the point where I need to be, I'm okay. Let her write her novel. I'll write mine. It's okay. So, you know, I still find ways to sabotage myself. But all in all, I really think it's a great way to encourage people to write. And one thing it does do, and this is me being a tiny bit, spiteful is too strong of a word, but you know, when you talk to someone and you say you're a writer and they're like, oh, I had an idea for a book. I think I'll write that someday when I get the time. And, you know, your little writer heart turns black with fury and you just want to smack them because they make it sound like it's so easy. And another thing NaNoWriMo will do is it shows you it's doable, but it's not easy.
Right. There's something very science fictional about Nano, isn't there? Like thousands of people around the world all coming together to kind of do this thing.
It does. And then you think about the stories behind all the people who eventually drop off. Or the people who only get 100, 200 words in and then they stop and you wonder, why? Why did you stop there? What happened? For me, it's always illness or Thanksgiving. That's what stops me.
There's probably a story in there about like these little 100 word novels that, you know, got lost along the way. And, you know, it's like the dead of Nano and where they've gone. I like that idea.
Kind of like the library and the dreaming from The Sandman with all the books ever not written,
right,
including that book I'll someday get to when I have the time. And you're criticized for that not being a very good title.
There's something very meta about like a Nano novel about Nano. And it reminds me of the new Scott Westerfeld novel.
Yes, but I read I've read the first chapter, and then my daughter grabbed the book, and so now she has it. But one thing that gets me is the character writes the book, finds the agent, and sells the book in the first page.
Yeah.
I understand it's not a book about her going through the process of writing, agent hunting, and then finding a publisher, but just the fact that he glosses that over in a couple of paragraphs, I was just like, oh, you can't, you gotta be kidding me. You can't just gloss this over. This is one of the hardest parts. But that's not really what the book's about. But still, it's just, oh, she wrote it. She sold it. Now the story starts.
Well, and I also think it was a NaNoWriMo novel in the story, which is funny because she doesn't revise it at all. She just writes it and then sends it out, which is just like, you know, the number one writing advice on NaNoWriMo is when you finish it, it's not done.
Yes.
So
yes.
I kind of got a kick out of that. But it's an interesting discussion about it's interesting to read it about an 18-year-old girl going into the New York writer scene, which I kind of enjoyed having an inside view of publishing. But it'll probably drive everybody else crazy who's wanting to be a writer. And then the image that he portrays is that it really is just that easy. But
yeah.
So you kind of talk about why NaNo is so important. But why do you still do it? I mean, as a writer who, again, is like established this ability to do it, and you don't really need a kickstart, and do you do it is for your own benefit or kind of in a show of solidarity to your peers?
I'd say mostly it's solidarity. I have a lot of listeners who do it, and I want to support them, and it's a challenge to myself. Like I said, I've never won, and you know, I did win the Campbell, but I've never won NaNoWriMo. So I'd kind of like to add that feather to my hat. It's, but yeah, it's solidarity. It's just, it's fun to talk about. It's fun to think about and do. And it's fun to think that you're, again, writing is a very lonely thing. And it's fun to be able to think that a whole bunch of people are doing it at the exact same time you are. And yeah, I have friends who are also full-time writers, and I see them on GChat all day. But really, it's also just that whole, I guess it's the weight of so many thousands of people all over the world doing it at the same time.
There are a number of people within the field that I could name. Chuck Wendig, Delilah Dawson, yourself. Cameron Hurley comes to mind. Cameron Hurley is always dispensing advice to what I call she calls the baby writers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to me that we've seen this culture of people who have gone through the trenches, right, have put in their time, have slaved away to selling the novel and then selling it and have built these careers. And a lot of cases have built their careers online first and then gone forth from there, who seem to feel like they have not a duty or responsibility, but like that they owe the community to continue to be active and try to encourage others. Do you see yourself as playing that kind of role and really trying to cultivate people that are where you were maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago?
I don't think I look at it like exactly that, but that's kind of why I started my podcast. So, and this was not like from the point of view of somebody who was an accomplished writer. It was just the point of view of saying, look, you know, I've been to the point where I got a rejection and thought, for real, I thought that my name was now on a blacklist, hung on the wall, saying never buy from this horrible, horrible writer ever again, or never buy for the first time because they're so terrible, and that people would remember my name, and that I could never go to a convention because they would be like, oh, there's that bad writer, and, you know, that I would be just stigmatized forever for writing one story that got rejected, and that I clearly had no talent and I had to quit. And I knew what that felt like. Every once in a while, I do think maybe I'll stop because I've certainly said a lot in the past 9 years, and I've repeated myself because not everybody is going to go back and listen to 300 some episodes. Well, much more than that, actually. But I know that new people are always listening, and the same message needs to be said over and over again because I need to hear it over and over again. Most of what I say on my show, I'm really just saying for my own benefit because I need to be reminded. And, you know, if I think I've talked about something too much, inevitably I'll get an email from someone going, I'm so glad you talked about this. I feel so much better now. Thank you. I've had people who've told me they've gone to get help after hearing me talk about depression. And so it's, you know, it's not just saying you want to give back to the community and saying all this stuff. It's when the response is so gratifying and you realize that, you know, you just, you know, Chuck Wendig saying how many different ways he can say foul words on his site and sprinkle in some writing advice at the same time and be greatly entertaining. If that helps people, then he should keep doing it. And I'm hearing that me say all of my insecurities into a microphone all the time, that being a positive for somebody else's life as well. So I should keep doing it.
I now have this image of Chuck sitting around saying foul words and you sitting around saying insecurities. It's like, it's
yes,
like the,
yes,
the buckets of writing advice.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what we do.
Now, of course, we can't talk about the National Novel Writing Month without talking about some of the negative connotations that are around it. And I think actually social media in some ways has hurt NaNoWriMo a little bit, because those of us who aren't participating in it, the social media feed the month of November tends to grate a little bit.
I bet.
Especially the hashtag #AmWriting.
Oh, that drives me crazy. I don't know. I mean, it's... Who follows that hashtag?
I don't know, but it always feels to me like it's sort of like this culture of writers seeking validation for the mere effort of creation. Which is bizarre to me.
Well, I think it's one of those things where if you're just starting out, then the validation's great. If you have been doing it for a while and you still need to put hashtag #AmWriting, that... I don't know. I just want to know who clicks on Am Writing and looks to see all the people who am writing. Because that seems like the most boring list ever. I mean, you could hit on hashtag whatever convention people are at to follow what's going on. But Am Writing just seems like, I don't know, just... I'd say something rude, but you didn't tell me how rude I could be on the tour.com show.
It's kind of like following like a bunch of strangers' Facebook status updates that are super lame. It's pretty much what it's like. It does seem like as we look, and I always have this experience at conventions, and NaNoWriMo kind of plays into this a little bit. You know, it's I remember a lot of times authors might say on a panel, you know, who in this room is a writer? And you'll see, I mean, 80% of the room at a convention will raise their hand when that question is asked. And it's this real interesting way that the cachet of being a writer plays within the community and how NaNoWriMo plays into that. It does seem to be they reinforce this idea that the mere effort of writing creates some level of credibility within the community that I think is an interesting discussion. I don't really know how to talk about it, because if you get deep into that, it can get pretty offensive pretty quick, but yeah.
Well, I think it's a fine line. Okay, the only metaphor that comes to mind is kind of lame, but just go with me here.
I'm with you.
Okay, you go to the dentist when you're a kid and you don't have any cavities, and they give you a toy and they give you a little thing with your picture on it saying No Cavity Club, and you're like, No Cavity Club, go me. And by the time you're 41, to pick a number completely at random, they don't give you that anymore, because you have evolved into just going to the freaking dentist and getting your cleaning and going on with your life. And it seems like people who want to be praised just for the act of writing, they need it at the beginning. They need that No Cavity Club. They need to know that, hey, this is cool. I did something good. Go me. Later on, they should just know that the words are their own reward. You don't need the No Cavity Club. You don't need the praise of just having written. You need to actually improve and keep going. So I think the little writer No Cavity Club of being praised for word count and everything by just for creating is good for a certain level of writer. But if you keep needing that validation, you'll be like me sitting in the dentist chair going, where's my toy? And then having my dentist look at me because he doesn't know my sense of humor and think that I'm really strange.
You know, Murr, you tried to play it off like that was going to be a shitty metaphor. That was actually a pretty good metaphor.
I want to be in the No Cavity Club. I seriously do.
Clearly, you are not putting enough words into your NaNoWriMo account if you can come up with that kind of metaphor on the fly. You need to drain those creative juices a little bit more, ma'am.
I'm sorry. I drove most of the day. I've only gotten 1,000 words yet so far today. Am writing.
Hashtag am writing. Now, I actually heard you at one point. I listened to an I Should Be Writing once where you were recording while driving.
Yep, I've done that.
Not on this trip, though.
No.
Okay. I'm going to try that sometime. Next time I have a big road trip, I'm totally recording a Rocket Talk on the road. It's going to happen.
I mean, it's not any worse than talking on your phone, which can be distracting. But, hey, you can at least stop talking and do what you need to do in the car. And you won't have someone going, hey, are you there? Hey, are you there?
It'll be a little awkward when I attach my my boom mic to the visor, the flip down visor, and all that.
You may need new equipment.
That's fair enough. I'll have to get a different rig. So you were on the forefront of the podcasting movement, and you've also kind of been on the edge of a few other technological things. I mean, Patreon hasn't been out very long, and you're on that. And you kickstarted a project way back in 2011. I don't know when Kickstarter started, but it wasn't much before that.
Right.
And
it was before the term stretch goals were used.
There you go. And
yeah.
So you kickstarted in 2011 your Afterworld novellas, which you funded successfully. I think you funded like 1,000% of goal or something absurd like that.
Yes, almost 1,000%.
Not that we're counting.
That was weird. That was weird, yes. That was a special, I would never expect to do that again, because that was a very special project where my listeners were absolutely in love with these books. And I've had more than one agent be after me too, because they loved the books. Publishers did not love the books. I've had more than one person try to sell it, and it will not sell. And people keep saying, when can I buy these books? I want to own these books. And so finally I just said, learned about Kickstarter and found someone to design the book for me and got a quote and just said, all right, you guys fund this book design and I'll do the ebooks, but you can have the physical books as a Kickstarter reward. And so all the people who'd been wanting these books for years just came out of the woodwork and it exploded. It got funded in like the first hour and a half. And then it just went crazy.
That's amazing. That must be like
the
best feeling.
It was very exciting. It was. But, you know, you've heard about people who go a little bit unhinged with the super successful Kickstarters. It's we indie creators are not set up to be distributors. Hmm. And so when things get too big, it can be overwhelming. And in some cases, it can be devastating because people just don't know what to do with that case. I just had a very patient family who dealt with, you know, a couple thousand books being in our living room for a couple of days. It's a lot of work. And I think about it, you know, the books that I got, I had a small press book published in 2008, and I kind of left it open and the small press kind of folded. So no one wants that sequel, but the readers do. And so I thought maybe I'll kickstart that. But I'm not sure if I want to be on the hook for all that I would be responsible for again.
Putting the potato salad guy to the side for a minute.
Yeah.
But, you know, like Michael Sullivan, when he, you know, I think he went out for $5,000 and ended up with like 30. I was talking to Brad Bollier about it, who has done a couple of successful Kickstarters. And it's the biggest challenge is you put together these anthologies, these projects, and you sell them to your backers. But where do you take it from there? You know, without distribution, without a marketing department or a sales department or a publicity department, they just kind of die at that point.
Yeah, that's what I wonder if, you know, as a reader, I've looked on Kickstarter and seen books or something and been like, that looks so cool. I want that, but I don't know how to get it after the Kickstarter is done.
Right. And that's, it still remains perhaps the biggest feather in the cap of traditional publishing is they're there forever, as long as they're in print anyway. But
yeah.
We asked you to write the introduction to Speculative Fiction 2012, our Hugo-nominated best-related work last year, in large part because of this, because it seems like to me that your career, much in the way of Scott Sigler and others, I mean, your career's been shaped by technology.
Oh, totally. Yeah, and you know, it's always weird because I didn't set out to have that happen. I didn't expect that to happen. I just thought, hey, I'll do this neat thing. And I built an audience and I kept working on my writing. And then I thought, hey, maybe I'll put some writing out there. And that worked. And it's just been, someone suggested that like I was being very smart for having shaped my career this way. And I'm like, I just tried something that seemed cool at the time. There was no grand scheming at all. I was just very lucky at the right time.
Of course, the biggest challenge of that, of course, is I'm sure people out there are like, oh my gosh, you know, this is how Murr did it. How can I do it like that? And your advice is don't do it like me, because it's hard to do it like me. I mean, it was kind of, you know, you can't do it this way. You have to find your own way.
Yeah, also because the world is different than it was when I got started. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, one of the tough things, because there's so many people. Like I said, it's very saturated now. Every year that goes by, there are more and more podcasts, and there are people who need to work harder to make your voice heard. And one thing that I don't know if it should bug me or not, I can see both sides of the story, but one thing that kind of bugged me for a while was shows that had pod faded would still show up on iTunes. So it's like you're sitting there busting your butt every week, but if you search for, say, to say my categories, like writing podcasts, some of the top search ones will be ones that aren't even updated anymore. And on one hand, well, if they're still there and they're still, people still find them useful, then yes, that's good. But come on, how hard do I have to work to leap over this dead podcast?
Mm-hmm. That's a real problem in some cases. And it's a challenge. You know, you got to cut through the signal to noise, I guess, which is, I think, one of the dangers of Kickstarter as we look at it. I mean, you obviously had a success back in 2011 and you haven't done it again yet.
ask me why.
Why?
Because I did not expect my $1,000 level, I'll write a new novella to sell. And when it did, I kind of froze. And then I got a 2-book deal, and then I went for my MFA, and then suddenly it was 3 years later, and I hadn't written the novella. And I knew that I could not do another Kickstarter with this one more thing to deliver hanging over my head, because I would be that person.
And that is Stones, right?
Yes. Yes. And which is finally done. And now that I've cut that albatross from my neck, I could possibly think about doing a Kickstarter in the future. But the main reason I haven't done it again is because I had not completed all of my deliverables from the Kickstarter I did a while back. And boy, did I learn some lessons. So that won't happen again.
But it does seem to me that as we look at Kickstarter now, there's so much on it. And we're seeing so many people taking books there that either didn't find a home in traditional publishing, or they feel like they have enough of an audience as an indie to do it. And then we were also
Or sequels,
right? That like in the Nightshade debacle, who published two, and then the new publisher didn't want the third, and so they're taking the third there. It's great for that. But we're also seeing a ton of anthologies. I mean, a real glut in my opinion of anthologies. And I just wonder, as somebody who has used Kickstarter in the past and might want to use it in the future, I mean, do you fear that like there's some sort of cheapening of the Kickstarter project, that people are going to start looking at it more with more suspicion?
Suspicious of what?
As more happens, right? I mean, there are always going to be good projects that are handled well and respectfully and delivered on time. But obviously, the more projects there are, the more problem projects there will be. It's just like statistics.
I see.
You know what I mean?
I see.
Do you think that the amateurism, as more and more of it occurs, people don't take it as seriously as some others might, that people will become more leery of it?
I don't worry about that, but that could be just because of my personal view of Kickstarter, which is, while I've only done one, and that was several years ago, I've been paying very close attention to Kickstarter. I've supported several of my own, and well, not of my own, but supported several as a consumer, and I've looked to see what makes a successful campaign and what doesn't. And the amateurs, it shows. It's like looking at Amazon or Smashwords and looking at the indie published. You can see who decided to slap together a cover and who actually worked hard. And you're going to pay more attention to the one who actually worked hard to give you a professional view of a book instead of just, you know, Comic Sans. I remember I seen a Kickstarter of like a girl detective. She was a black girl detective in space. And I thought this was the coolest idea ever. I wanted it for my daughter. I wanted to support it. And I looked, and they didn't have this back when I did it, but they now have like, what challenges do you see in your future, like what could happen that will not make this project actually happen. She's like, I've never written a book before. And I'm like, well, okay, great idea, but I'll see you maybe 10 years and see how your career is going then. You know, people who don't put a lot of time into their actual Kickstarter campaign, you can tell they won't put a lot of time into a book. People whose Kickstarter campaign reads like, you know, an email from your kid written on their phone, you know, is not going to be a good book. So, I guess I trust myself to be able to spot a person who's not, I want to say professionally created, I don't want to say by professionals, but somebody who's willing to put in the work to make it as professional as possible. They're pretty obvious.
I've backed a few and chose not to back some others, as I've looked at it. And, you know, there haven't been many that have failed, that are well put together, and I haven't had anybody not deliver on me yet.
Mm-hmm.
Although I know some people who have had that problem or very late delivery, but it just is somebody who I think, and I look at it as somebody who likes to try to theorize about where things are going a little bit. I just look at it and I just wonder how long we'll continue to go down this road. And as we look at the barriers of gatekeeper publishing, and then elsewise, I mean, you've now done both sides of the game. I mean, you've done it on your own. You've done it with Kickstarter. You've published with Orbit. Now that you've kind of done all these different things, do you see yourself as continuing to do both sides of the equation, or do you see yourself more attracted to one or the other?
I think it really depends on the project. If I really believe in a project and no one is interested in it, I may try to crowdfund it. If I keep getting book contracts, then I would probably take that over crowdfunding because it's a lot easier. It really is. I don't have to worry about the cover, and my art director can get a Jamie McKelvey cover when I don't think I could have. Things like that. So
those Jamie McKelvey covers kick ass.
Oh God, I loved them. I was so excited, and I got to meet him in London, which I didn't expect because he wasn't at LondonCon. I met him at a party outside of the con, and that was a hugest thrill. And I was just so thrilled that I still haven't had a book cover that Jim Hines can make fun of yet.
And it's not hard for Jim Hines to make fun of a book cover. So.
Exactly. My character's dressed like a normal person, and she's posed like a normal person. It's great.
I will say Orbit does a really good job with that.
Yeah.
Even their more, you know, campy urban fantasy stuff is still generally, like, very good, solid, respectful book covers. All right, Murr. Well, you're at World Fantasy Con. I've kept you for far too long already. So I want to thank you for coming on the Rocket Talk.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's always fun to talk to you, even though there's actually no alcohol in sight for either of us. Well, I'm not sure about you, but I'm guessing not.
No, I'm technically still at the office.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, so
no,
this might have been the first conversation we've had without a drink.
I know. What does that sell? God.
Murr
and Justin are liquored up normally.
Well, no, we usually see each other at cons.
I know. It's been a while. But we saw each other at LondonCon. We'll probably hang out again, maybe at next WorldCon, maybe.
Excellent.
I will be there. Well, I hope I'll be there. We'll see if my wife lets me go.
Good luck.
I need to be nominated for a Hugo again. That's like the only way I'm going to get her to let me go. So we'll see how it goes.
All right. Well, we'll work on that. Rocket Talk for best fan cast.
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know if we're eligible. It's a professional magazine that this is published on. I don't know. Hell, I don't know.
Related work, then.
Maybe. I don't know. These Hugo categories are shenanigans.
I know.
I never know.
Trust me, I know.
I should be writing, should be nominated for a fan cast. I'm just saying it right now. You don't
well,
have to
make
say
it again. Say it again come January.
I will. I'll announce it here first. I'm working on a series of posts for Tor.com about the Hugos, what's eligible, what's not eligible, what should be nominated, what shouldn't be nominated. So that'll be coming in the next couple of months. So watch
That's
for
awesome.
It.
That's awesome. I will. I will totally watch for it.
Thanks for coming on, Murr.
Oh, thanks, Justin. It's fun.
All right. This has been Rocket Talk.